How's the silence going? Enjoying it? It's for week two arrivals, it's a little bit like hitting the brakes, going 60 miles an hour, but helpful. So this is, developing our what's called in the tradition rousing bodhicitta or awakening bodhicitta. Means that there are two aspects to bodhicitta. There's what's called ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. And I thought it might be helpful for us to just understand, that framework. Now, the interesting point I was mentioning the other day that citta means, it's translated in the West as mind. Bad translation, totally misleading. I mentioned that citta derives from a Sanskrit root, chit, C-I-T. Sanskrit is made up of monosyllabic roots. It's a very interesting language, and all of the nouns actually derive from verbs. The whole language, the underpinning of the entire Sanskrit language is verbs, movement. There's no solidity anywhere. It's very much like the quantum world. We were talking last week that there is no solid matter. Even a proton is made up of strings, which are vibrating energy. There is no solid matter anywhere. And among the languages, Sanskrit represents that. And chit means to experience. It means to feel something, to know something. It's the act of experience, the act of cognizance, you could say. And citta means our capacity to experience. And as I mentioned, citta is here. This is the citta. It is the heart that is our capacity to experience life and death. Mind doesn't really come into it, actually. The concept of the thinking mind is known in the Indian tradition, but it's relatively unimportant. It's not really of spiritual interest. It's a handmaiden, as I mentioned. It's a helpmate to the knowing heart. So when we talk about sort of ultimate citta, bodhicitta, well, we better talk about bodhi. So citta is the human capacity to know, to experience. And all of creation has that same ability. Everything that has come into being has the capacity, it knows, it has its own way of experiencing and knowing. So this is not a uniquely human thing at all. But because we're human beings, then obviously we're interested in our particular, way of doing this, experiencing. Bodhi means not asleep. Buddha is the Sanskrit root. It means to be awake, to wake up. And Bodhi is one of the substantives. There are many substantives that come from the same root. The U in Sanskrit, the U changes into an O. There are certain conversions that happen in the vowel system. So Bud, Buddha, Bodhi, Bodhisattva, they're all coming from the same root. And to when we talk about bodhicitta, we are talking about a heart that is not somnambulant. We're talking about a heart that is not asleep. Now, it's interesting, where does enlightenment come into it? Enlightenment doesn't come into it. What we think of as enlightenment. When we talk about bodhicitta, we are talking about a heart that is awake, a heart that is not sleeping, a heart that abides within its true capacity, its full capacity. And this heart is the basis of the journey. The knowingness of the heart is the basis of the journey. We make the journey through trusting our heart. And this is not some kind of romantic, you know, we should just trust our hearts, you know, we should trust whatever we feel. It's not quite like that. Trusting the heart is a very radical and powerful way of being human. As I was saying yesterday, trusting the heart means trusting the very subtle, non-conceptual knowingness that is in our being. Trusting the heart means taking our guidance for our life from what we know to be so, not conceptually or intellectually or morally or ethically or philosophically or theologically or conventionally, but in each one of us there is a deep sense of knowing, and that is the Bodhi, means the not sleeping chitta heart. So this heart of ours has two aspects, ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. But the important point is they are both 100% somatic. And I mean 100%. I don't mean 99.9. I mean 100% somatic. Bodhicitta is, it's pre-conceptual. It's direct. In the West, we have we don't have a lot of terms for it, but we could talk about direct intuition. We can talk about the authentic voice of the person. We can talk about our true self, whatever you want to say. You know, they're all equivalent. But the thing is, it happens here and it doesn't happen anywhere else. So this is very challenging for all of us. We have to, you know, because we live in a culture where the left brain, the conceptual brain, is so emphasized, and people are rewarded or punished based on their ability to stay in their left brain. Isn't that interesting? Staying in the left brain from an indigenous viewpoint is total insanity. It's insanity to live your life out of what you think. It's insanity to live your life out of in a state of complete disconnection where the only thing that counts is your ability to rearrange memory and concepts. But we live in a culture, literally, where people are rewarded and punished based on their ability not just to live in their left brain, but to cut off the right brain. I always think of this example. Somebody in business told me that in his corporation that you are not allowed to have moods. You're not allowed to be depressed. You are evaluated on your ability to never to have a human life. And you know, if you need to stay home, you know, if your child is very sad and you need to be with your child, these are all points against you. You know, if you take seriously your human feeling and the natural cycle of your emotional life, those are points against you, and you will be punished. You will be held back. So we live in a, you know, we live in a culture that really, more and more and more, the facsimile of life that happens on the internet is replacing real life, and we know this. Everybody's seen Social Network. Everybody's read the books. Everybody's, you know, seen the studies, and nobody can do anything about it. And we see the whole thing sort of slipping in a direction of virtual relationships and virtual human life. And you know, one of our students' husband has this thing called, what is it called, virtual? That one that where you live your whole life on the internet? What is it called? Second Life. Yeah, and like you even have like sex with people on the internet with facsimiles. And pretty soon, you don't actually have to have any interaction with anybody because you can do everything on the internet through this facsimile kind of life. And you can think that you're actually having a life. I mean, think about it. This is not a good situation. We're not moving in a good direction. So this is our situation. And our challenge is to come back. Come back to our body. And when we come back to our body, we're coming back to a way of knowing the world that is as old as human life itself. We're coming back to a way of knowing the world where we are connected with everything. And everything around us has its own life and its own being and its own value. We're coming back to a way of being where otherness is everywhere, and the power and the journey that happens when we relate with true others happens for us. We come back to a way of being where we see the world not through our agendizing mind, but in itself. And you know, these, I mentioned last week, these, one of these interesting neurological discoveries called mirror neurons mean that we not only can feel what other people feel, but we can actually become them. We can know what it's like to be them. And this is in our basic makeup. Interesting. So, you know, the situation in the world is very difficult, and a lot of people are in a tremendous amount of pain, and there's a huge amount of confusion. But the amazing news is that our capacity to heal is in us, and it doesn't take that much for things to shift. It's almost as if the imbalance of the human person is an anomaly. It's not you know, it's a state of disequilibrium. It can't maintain itself. And it's interesting, often, you know, when we do our first solitary retreat, we suddenly find ourselves becoming a different person. You know, all you have to do is just get away from all of the mechanisms that support the neurotic imbalance of modern culture, and all of a sudden your psyche starts healing. You know, people say, well, what should I do in my retreat? Well, what should I do? I should do something. I mean, what am I supposed to do? And the only thing is what you shouldn't do. You know, don't take your iPhone. Don't take your computer. Don't take, you know, a bunch of books. Don't take, you know, anything that you use to distract yourself. And what you do on retreat doesn't really matter, because you get into that environment where you're not constantly, you know, maintaining this very neurotic, imbalanced, pathological state of the modern ego, and all of a sudden you just start healing. It's like coming here. It's so interesting for me, you know, we come and sit, we do Roryoki. Basically, you're being distracted from what you normally do. I mean, that's the plan behind Dhatan. That's the secret plan. We just distract you from what you normally do. And all of a sudden, incredibly powerful things start happening. I mean, that's how close it is. All you have to do is sit down, try to eat with these like damn chopsticks, eat food you don't really like, and it's like incredibly frustrating, and you're totally preoccupied, and all of a sudden the lineage is talking to you, and your life is opening up, and your journey is unfolding. And the reason is because that's what has been wanting to happen your whole entire life. But the, you know, modern culture, do you know this phrase twiddling in terms of autism? Do you know what that is? It's a thing that children will often do when they're autistic to filter out, not to let the impact of the outside world in. And I feel a lot of modern culture is that kind of thing. You know, it's a series of behaviors we have developed as modern people, so we don't really have to encounter reality or meet another person or actually feel life. But the thing is, to keep it going, you have to keep it going. You have to spend your whole entire day in a series of evasions, evasionary tactics all day long. That's what modern culture largely is. It's evading the human heart. Because the information of the human heart, once that starts coming through, then we're stopped in our tracks, as you know. And we really have to take a look. It really raises questions for us, like, well, who am I? And what am I doing? And what is my life about? And once you're willing to ask those kind of questions, the information from the bigger universe begins to flow through, as you know. It's very beautiful. It's incredibly moving. It's incredibly powerful. So, you know, we are doing a very simple thing here. We're doing practices that are simply bringing us back to the natural condition of our own humanity. We're coming back to the natural situation, the basis of our human experience, which is our heart. You know, it's interesting, this is something I quote all the time, but William Blake, who is one of the first Western Vajrayana people, said that, it's like, well, how do people change? You know, how does spiritual transformation happen? You know, we live in a very, I mean, he lived in a time that was very, you know, agonizing. It was a, you know, very agonizing period of Western history in England. How do people change? And he said, people change by being given permission to experience their experience. People change simply through their own naked human experience. And it's interesting, that is what the human heart knows. The human heart knows how it is with us. It knows what our experience is. And then, of course, we override it with all kinds of things. But the heart knows. When we learn to listen to the heart and follow the journey that the heart holds for us, then we begin to inhabit our true life. It's almost as if we have been wandering in the wilderness for a long time, and through doing the practices we're doing, we meet someone. And she leads us off out of the wilderness into a deep, cool jungle. A so beautiful and so green, and the fragrance of the flowers, and moist, cool. And she takes us to a glade in a pool of water. And she lets us know that she has things to show us about life. Many secrets and many mysteries and many subtleties. And she is our heart. She wants to lead us home. She wants to help us find our way. And the only way we can do that is by being willing to be at her feet, so to speak, her student, her devotee, even. She has so much she wants to show us, but we have to realize who she is. We have to come back to her and begin to feel and to see and to sense from her viewpoint. We need to learn how to feel our heart, and then we need to begin to trust what we feel. And then we need to be willing to act on what we feel and build our life around it, even if it doesn't make any sense from a conceptual standpoint.